This is on. You can hear me? Good. Good morning. And thank you for the warm welcome here. And it's very nice to be back in Henderson County. I don't get back here very often. I do want to clarify one thing from the record. I am from Flat Rock. And no, folks in Flat Rock think, and you know, the accent's a little bit different there. And I'm unclear whether they think it's heaven or a haven, but they really think it's a special place. And I think Hendersonville is kind of a place you go out for supplies or something like this. That's my recollection, at least. I haven't lived in Henderson County for a long time, but I do remember it as a very good place to grow up, and I had some great mentors and teachers here. And I had really good parents. They were a bit bewildered when I moved to the Gaza Strip. They couldn't figure out where the former Yugoslavia was. Neither could the Bosnians or the Serbs either, for that matter. But they wondered what in the world I was doing in Cambodia. They were very perplexed by my politics, to say the least. Right and left probably doesn't quite describe it. One on way end on the spectrum and me on the other. I fell a long way from the path of the kind of Presbyterian path, but I will say they were very good people and they always supported me. And I was really fortunate that I married extremely well. My wife Dee is here. And all they said, Dee, is this okay? And if she said it was okay, it was okay. If I said it was okay, it was not okay. So we had a pretty good, thing going. I also wanted to just, Keith mentioned the Thomases here, and Mrs. Thomas was a very good friend of my mother and dad, and Mary and I were supposed to be born about the same day, but Mary beat me out by a week or two, and I remember Jim very well as well. And I am particularly moved by Mrs. Thomas's brave move some years back when she and the First Presbyterian Church split over marriage equality, and she did the right thing. She really did. Congratulations. I'm very proud of her. There weren't many in that group that would have done the right thing, and she did. One other note before I talk about my work. Today is the birthday of my paternal grandfather, who's been gone for a long, long time. I never knew him. But I took his life as a great inspiration for my career. He was a lawyer in South Carolina. He was a Republican when the Republicans were the party of Lincoln. My family opposed the Civil War. They opposed slavery. And my grandfather was a progressive lawyer in the 1930s in South Carolina. He came under tremendous pressure from the Ku Klux Klan. He defended African Americans. They were beaten up on thrown up on his porch. Crosses were burned in his yard. His jaw was broken by white supremacists on Main Street in Greenville, South Carolina. And he ultimately, under all this pressure, committed suicide. And that was celebrated by the Ku Klux Klan and other hooligans. But his life has been a great inspiration to mine. And since it's his birthday, I thought I would mention that. I also wanted to mention Keith Thalbach, who is a very special teacher to me. Growing up in Henderson County, I didn't have all that many allies, to be honest. And in Hendersonville High School, I was a lonely light. Keith was like a lighthouse, his course that I took that senior year. All I can say, I was really, really fortunate. I don't think I would be standing here today. I don't think I would have had the career that I had without his support and his guidance. And I owe a lot to him. Much of my life and career has really centered on the protection and advancement of human rights, principally when there have been massive abuses of those rights, genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes. Just to take a few examples, the genocide in Srebrenica that some of you will recall from 2 days in July of 1995 when 8,000 Bosnian men and boys were systematically murdered, something I worked at extensively on at the Yugoslavia Tribunal. In Argentina, 30,000 people were disappeared. So one of the most persistent crimes that we see, that we deal with, disappeared, leaving the family not knowing where their loved one was, without any recourse. Most of those people in Argentina were thrown out of airplanes over the Atlantic Ocean. In Cambodia, where I worked extensively, somewhere between 25 and 40% of the population was systematically killed, or they were worked to death by the Khmer Rouge. These were not hidden murders. If you go to the S21 prison camp where I've been, there's a photograph of each of the 14,000 people who were murdered in that camp. There were 13 survivors out of 14,000 people, and each picture is there. It's now a memorial, which is a good thing, but you can see the depravity behind that. And today, as we speak, there are many crimes being committed around the world, but particularly in Syria. The Geneva Conventions, which are the backbone of international humanitarian law, have really been shredded. And in a whole variety of other countries, we see failures to address recurrent social issues. We see racial division, a lack of trust in institutions. And so the question I've really struggled with in my career, or worked on, and particularly over the last almost 8 years as president of the International Center of Transitional Justice, is how can societies respond to these massive human rights abuses, these crimes against humanity, torture, atrocities? How do you reestablish trust? You know, ultimately, a society is based on trust, a trust in the governmental institutions to protect you, not to abuse you, to protect your rights. That leads to the rule of law and not to the rule of the barrel of the gun. So these societies that have been through these enormous crimes where authority has been abused, how do we help those societies rebuild themselves that have been torn apart? And I think we intuitively know that you cannot simply turn the page. You cannot simply say the past is over and we're going to restart it. As Faulkner, one of my favorite writers, says, the past is not even past. These abuses, these violations have to be addressed. They can't simply be swept under the proverbial carpet. They have to be grappled with through accountability, through acknowledgement, apologies, redress, reforms, and an accurate understanding of what happened in the past. Or to put it more simply, the victims and the society need to know the truth and wrestle with the truth. It's an immensely difficult process. There are deep grievances, obviously, particularly for the victims, to be addressed. So how do we help them reestablish trust in a state that has essentially violated that duty to protect, that's turned on them because of their color or their tribe, their ethnicity, their sexuality? Ethnic minorities, children, women, and other groups face particularly horrendous crimes and abuses. When I was deputy chief prosecutor at the Yugoslavia Tribunal, we tried cases of rape camps with girls that were under 12 years old. I don't think I have to say much more about what a rape camp is. What's called ethnic cleansing, mass murder. And also we see that women often suffer very disproportionately in traditional societies, particularly when they lose the breadwinner, and they're very, very much left adrift and discriminated against. Children are particularly vulnerable. The child soldier phenomena in West Africa, where you have children of 12 being put into combat. I had the privilege of addressing the UN Security Council on this issue a few years ago. But we'd face these enormously difficult issues. The first step is really returning the country to peace. But the question is, how does a society, even in a tenuous peace, begin to rebuild trust in the governing structures that failed to protect them before? How do you rebuild the institutions or build the institutions for the first time? The police, the government, the judicial system. And how do we help them prevent going back or lapsing into lawlessness or into an authoritarian state? So these are the difficult questions that we deal with at my organization, the International Center for Transitional Justice. Essentially, what we're trying to do is help the future to be based on the rule of law and not the rule of the gun. And experience shows across a whole variety of countries and with different cultures and different kinds of conflict that the past, as I say, really has to be addressed. Some countries have had the approach of amnesia or just acting like, say, it's argued to turn the page. That, in our experience, and I think history shows, simply returns to a repeated cycle of violence. I think if you look at the Middle East, for example, where I spent much of my career, we see that we have these cycles of violence and the past is never addressed. There's never been any accountability, even for the countries in the regions or from the outsiders. The West has a lot of responsibility for what's happened in the Middle East, the United States, the British, the French. No one has ever really been held accountable. I think of the United States in this context. After the Civil War, we failed to address the issue of slavery and the continuing abuses of African Americans, including segregation and other practices up to this day. And we're grappling with it because we failed to address it. Unfortunately, we're in very good company. Most major powers in a lot of countries have done the same, that is to fail to address these issues. But there are some very good examples of countries that have grappled with the past, who've addressed the past in very effective ways. I think of Germany. Germany was the heart of darkness in the 30s, the Nazi period. The crimes utterly boggle the mind. I'm on the advisory board of the Nuremberg Academy, and I've been through the museums, I've read the books, and they're the worst crimes of perhaps in all of human history. It's true that the Allies came in and held the Nuremberg trials, but Germany itself is a radically different place than it was a few years ago after the war. They took an array of transitional justice measures. They had trials. They put on trials of their senior leadership. Any of you who are familiar with this, the Auschwitz trials in Frankfurt in the 50s massively changed the narrative in that country. It provided reparations to many victims. There was a strong program of denazification in the administration. They built memorials to the victims. Any of you who have been to Berlin will have seen the enormous and incredible museums, memorials and museums that are there. Something that, by the way, we lack totally in this country with respect to slavery. I'll come back to that in a moment. They completely redid their public administration. And in the school curriculum, which I think is so important, the history, the truth is reflected about what happened in that society. I compare that to what I read in the third and fourth grade when I was coming along. I think the history books are a lot better today, but for many, many years, they didn't tell the true story about slavery. And one of the great symbolic acts when I think of transitional justice and our work is when Willy Brandt, the Chancellor of Germany, the head of the government, fell to his knees in what's called the Kniefall in the Warsaw Ghetto. It's a tremendous symbolism, because this is about symbolism as well as action. An aside, my good friend Tom Bergenthal, who was a judge on the International Court of Justice, and he was the youngest survivor of Auschwitz. His story is amazing. You should get his book. You can get it online. I'll send you the link. He became this leading figure in international justice, and he was on the International Court of Justice. You can't get any higher in the international legal world we, my wife and I, Dee, saw him receive the highest civilian offer, highest civilian honor, the medal, the highest medal awarded by the German government. It shows the trajectory of the change. Germany made a clear break with the past. They addressed the past. And I think also in places where we get a lot of inspiration from in our work, in Argentina, a number of other Latin American countries, such as Chile and Peru and Uruguay, they've opened up the archives. They've exposed these shocking crimes, you know, massive disappearances and forced disappearances in these countries. And the impact on disappearances is terrible on the families. You don't know where your loved one is, usually your father or your brother, but it can be, you know, other members of the family as well. It takes their breadwinner away frequently. But the main concern is they don't know. And opening up the archives actually brings some closure for them. They've had truth commissions across Latin America, sometimes referred to as truth and reconciliation commissions. Victims are allowed to tell their stories. Recommendations are made to prevent reoccurrence, like reforming the police, the military, governing structures. Of course, probably the best-known truth commission is the South African one under Bishop Tutu after the apartheid era. It has a lot of good features, but it was hardly perfect, and I always push back when people come to me and start talking about the South African experience, because there are a lot of aspects of it that I don't agree with it, but there were a lot of very good things as well. For example, there was an amnesty for serious crimes. That's really no longer permissible under international law. And there have now been some 40 truth commissions around the world, and we at ICTJ have a lot of expertise in this area. At the moment, we at ICTJ, my organization, we're working across the globe, providing expertise. We work closely with civil society and victims groups, and also with governments, providing this kind of comparative experience. Keith mentioned Colombia, where we've worked extensively both with the government and with the rebels, the FARC rebels, to reach a peace agreement. It was a 50-year conflict with 50,000 dead, so enormous issues. A lot of compromises were made, but I'm proud to say that with a lot of assistance from my organization, transitional justice measures, including a truth commission, a special jurisdiction for criminal justice, reparations, and a number of reforms are at the heart of that agreement. We're also working extensively in Tunisia, the only country in the Arab Spring that actually sort of putters along in terms of the reform. There's the Truth and Dignity Commission. The dignity term is something that's very strong in the Arab world and I think has religious connotations, and this is one of the really important things if you're going to work on these issues, is to understand the cultural context. And earlier this year, I went to the hearings, the first public hearings of the Truth and Dignity Commission, and it electrified the nation. I mean, in both a positive way, in the sense that these crimes were described. They're harrowing. Electric shocks, sexual attacks, sexual abuse. But it also exposed the prior regime for what they did. And I think what was really important, and what we did at ICTJ, is we brought our communications director in. And it was broadcast across the region, so it was heard in Morocco and it was heard in Iraq. And it opens a window for the possibilities for justice in the future. These are very long-term processes, obviously. And one of the key questions we ask is, what does justice look like to the victim? Because if it's not justice for the victim, if victims feel like they're bypassed, and their process, then the kind of healing and the kind of acknowledgement for the future is not going to happen. So this is, I think, a really an important element, and issues of culture are really critical to address, and that's one of the reasons that we advise, at least, and we don't tell people what to do. What we try to do is help them think about this and use comparative experiences, but have a wide consultation with victims and affected communities so that they can have an impact on the way forward. There are a lot of challenges right now. There's, in many places, there's no transition and certainly no transition to democracy like we had Latin America or South Africa. We're seeing cycles of violence that are even more difficult to break. And unless there is accountability and acknowledgement and redress, at least my experience, and I think the world's experience, is that these will repeat themselves. We're finding ourselves pulled into Syria, which is obviously a massive conflict, very confused, and also with players who are not interested in dealing with the past at all. But I think if Syria is to have any hope, ultimately they will have to wrestle with their past. They'll have to wrestle with these massive human rights abuses that have actually gone on for generations. Just to kind of close out, I was asked by Ron and Keith to give a few thoughts about my work and how it's an impact on my own life. I'm not a very touchy-feely kind of person, but I do feel incredibly fortunate to have worked at senior levels at the UN, to work on the prosecution of the most serious perpetrators in Bosnia and the former Yugoslavia. We accounted for everyone we indicted. We tried 121 individuals, and I also worked extensively with the national authorities on prosecutions. I've been in over. My father told me, in a moment of agreement, that he said, "Dave," only my father calls me Dave, but anyway, he said, "You're living your dream." In one way, I am, although there are some nightmarish qualities to that dream, I guess. But I've met with presidents and political figures and a number of secretary generals, many great people. I think most importantly, courageous activists. Those are the people who give me the greatest inspiration. There is a deep frustration that in this huge sea of human folly and massive suffering, there's a limited amount that you can do. And particularly where I am now, which I think we do really good work, but we're a relatively small nonprofit, and it takes enormous dedication to get over the political, financial, and other roadblocks that stand in our way. I spent a decade working in the Balkans for the UN, and if you look, the progress is slim indeed. So there is frustration, and there are a lot of challenges. On the other hand, I would say that I do have a renewed faith when I go to places like Tunisia and I see these courageous activists put their lives or their freedom on the line and they tell the truth and you can see progress. So there is, I think, on the whole, something very moving about this work and something very Unitarian about this work, perhaps. I also just wanted to say that we have a lot of issues in our own country that I think at least some of the lessons that we've learned are relevant. I mean, my shock is, I can hardly say it, Charlottesville, Jews will not replace us. This is an incredible thing in this country. So I think we have a lot to do in this country. And if any of you are interested, I'm doing a conversation for our annual lecture with Darren Walker, who's the president of the Ford Foundation. And he is a leading African-American activist. And Sherry Eiffel, Gwen Eiffel's cousin, who's head of the NAACP Defense Fund. I'll send you the links. It's in November. You may want to watch that because we're exploring how these experiences from abroad are very relevant. And I do, in closing, despite challenges and disappointments, I feel a kind of and this is maybe the most important thing for me, I feel this kind of intergenerational solidarity between the struggles that I help, I'm not really on the front line, and my grandfather, who was on the front line. And that gives my life inspiration. It's this kind of intergenerational struggle for the cause of human rights and human dignity. Thank you very much.